Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome everybody to the last show of the week. This is the Friday Damage Report. We usually do it casual and I just forgot. Also, I started physical therapy recently and they've begun cupping me, which is sort of a weird practice that has left my arm absolutely destroyed with bruises and things like that. So not so casual today, but we do have a big show in store for you. We're going to be starting off with possibly the dumbest thing I've seen on Twitter this year, which is certainly saying something. We'll have that for you in just a little bit, but we also have a lot of other important news as well. Casual jokes about voter suppression in Mississippi. We'll have that for you. An update on the Kroger shooting having to do with the possibility that there will be hate crimes convictions in that. We have an awesome guest joining us later on the show to talk about Maine's new ranked choice voting system, which has already decided an election in a very exciting way. So we're going to be talking about that as applied to Maine, but also the possibility for ranked choice voting to be spread around the country. We have an update on Jim Acosta's lawsuit, and we'll be closing out the week as we always do, taking a look back and figuring out what it is that we actually learned. But hold on to your butts because it's about to get real dumb up in here. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has a particular talent, not only in inspiring people on her side to, you know, admire her and want her to succeed and all of that, but also just getting under the skin of the right in a really weird way. And she is already inspiring crazy ageism, racism, misogyny coming at her. Eventually, I assume the right will come up with some sort of like issues-based arguments against her, but right now they've settled on clothing for the most part. And so it keeps coming up in different forms, and we've got the dumbest version of that opposition to AOC for you now. Eddie Scari is technically a journalist for the Washington Examiner, and he tweeted this yesterday. Hill staffer sent me this pic of Ocasio-Cortez they just took now. I'll tell you something, that jacket and coat don't look like a girl who struggles. So first of all, you can't tell necessarily from the graphic we're showing you, but that is sort of a screenshot someone had already taken of the tweet rather than us live taking a screenshot. And the reason for that is that Eddie Scari eventually deleted that tweet. He really hung in there and we'll describe how, but that tweet, which is so obviously condescending, stupid and misogynistic. I mean, not only is this a man looking at a woman walk by in a hallway and saying, I know that coat, that's an expensive coat, which I don't think most people wandering the halls of the Hill can actually do. He calls her a girl, which is, she's a congresswoman elect. She's not a girl. I mean, no 29-year-old should be referred to as a girl to begin with, but certainly not a politician, you know, with the level of support that she does. But he did that, and he's implying that if she has a coat, she can't be struggling in the way that she has. And what he's doing there is he's continuing that weird argument against her where when she recently said that she would have trouble affording an apartment in DC until her congressional salary kicks in, they think that that's insane, that this woman who made, I believe, $26,000 last year as a bartender should have trouble living in literally the most expensive rent area of the US, they think is laughable. And they believe that they have a counter argument to it. If we ever see her wearing anything nice, she must be lying. And if she ever owns outerwear, she can't actually be a democratic socialist because we know they run around nude. That's actually the argument that you are seeing play out in tweet after tweet, Fox News segment after Fox News segment. Now, thankfully, she caught not only his initial misogynistic attack, but also the fact that he deleted his tweet. And she called him out on both parts of that. So in this next tweet, she says, oh, does E. Scari think he can delete his misogyny without an apology? Which is a nice rhyme there, too. I don't think so. You're a journalist. Readers should know your bias. She's technically right there. As I said in the beginning, he does technically write for the Washington Examiner. At the end of this segment, we're going to show you some of the other things he's tweeted. It is going to be very interesting to see if he maintains his job at the Washington Examiner after this. But that wasn't her actual substantive response to this attack. She tweeted that earlier saying, if I walked into Congress wearing a sack, they would laugh and take a picture of my backside. If I walk in with my best sale rack clothes, they laugh and take a picture of my backside. Dark hates light, that's why you tune it out. Shine bright and keep it pushing. Which is awesome. Now, she's done this before. If you remember her Slayin' Looks tweet, she really does know how to point out the insane arguments against her in a very concise way, and also come across as the bigger, more inspiring figure. She does that consistently. She's doing that here. But I want to give credit to some other people on Twitter as well, because when he initially tweeted out that photo, which he says someone gave to him, we're going to examine the evidence as to whether that's true in just a minute. There was a great deal of reaction from leftist Twitter. So first, Jordan Ull tweeted, "I too am disappointed Ocasio didn't show up wearing only a wooden barrel held up by suspenders and carrying her few belongings in a bindle," which is great. Ken Klippenstein, who's been on the show several times, said, "Ocasio-Cortez claims to be middle class, but she owns Squint's clothes." That is a great point. And look, you've now seen the picture like 10 times. Can we put up the picture one more time of her walking in the hallway? Like, look at that. Can you honestly say whether that coat costs $5, $50, or $5,000? How would you know? You have no idea. But how dare she be democratic socialist who wears something with sleeves? And she's wearing shoes, like some hoity-toity princess up in here wearing shoes. So anyway, look, now let's talk briefly about Eddie Scari. So what Eddie Scari did, I believe, is he took a picture of her without her consent and posted it, lied about the fact that it had been given to him. I'm gonna show you that evidence in just a second. He wants to score points by implying that if you actually care about income inequality, raising the minimum wage, if you care about the condition of the American workforce, then you can't actually ever look nice or put together. Although, as she points out, if she came in wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt, I think they'd mock her for that too. And he wanted to get credit as like this clever guy. If you go through his Twitter history, he very much thinks that he's a very smart, clever guy. And so he stood with this thing, even as that initial tweet had something like, at one point, I think 30 retweets and 7,000 replies. The definition of ratioed on Twitter, so much so that Merriam-Webster tweeted the ratio when the whole entire internet gets together to dunk on you. Just coincidentally, they didn't tweet him or anything, but you knew what they were getting at. Now, he did what conservatives have been taught to do under Donald Trump. He just tweeted through it. And tweet after tweet after tweet, implying that the opposition of the tweet had to do with the fact that we think he took the picture, which I do think he took the picture, but that's not what our issue actually is, or that we're misunderstanding the point that he's trying to make or something like that. Everybody knew immediately what he was doing there, and he didn't want to accept it. Now, as of right now, he still has not apologized to AOC for either taking the picture without her consent or tweeting about her in such a misogynistic way. He did delete the initial tweet, although if you go on his Twitter, which you shouldn't, you'll see the literally dozens of tweets that he's done since then, including trying to push his, I almost swore, his book because of this controversy, saying, oh, if you're interested in me now, take a look at this book that I wrote in response to Michael Wolff's book earlier this year, which was published in, I believe, March. And a sign of quality for an investigative book in political science, I would say, is when you can write it in 4 weeks after another book comes out. That's definitely going to be a winner. But he apparently has learned nothing. I will give you his last tweet on this matter. He says, "Attention, I posted a tweet earlier suggesting the incoming congresswoman looked well put together, elegant even, despite suggestions she struggled. The tweet was taken as something else, so I've deleted it." This is basically the arc that you have witnessed is right-wing media, punditry, comedy, whatever you want. It's saying something, then deciding whether you were joking or not based on the reaction to it, refusing to insist that anything you did was inappropriate, claiming that people are only misunderstanding you, and then in this particular case, claiming that the point of your tweet was to say that she looked elegant. Does anyone, if you're a lib, if you're a conservative, you're watching the show, do you actually believe that that's what he was doing? That's not what he was doing. But I want to go back a little bit farther. So he would like you to believe that this is just a one-off thing. Eddie Scari, the journalist, is a weirdo. And that's not just my opinion. I want to take a look at some of the other tweets he has sent out over the years. Check out this one. "Check out the bunion on this otherwise cute woman's foot." And if you're listening to the podcast, it is a photo of a woman's legs, maybe sitting in a cafe. And he has taken a photo of her legs and foot and has posted it on Twitter back in August of 2012 to point out that this woman who would otherwise be attractive has a bunion that he noticed because he apparently walks around cafeterias staring at women's feet and then posting photos non-consensually on Twitter. He also posted this in 2013. "Just saw a very special person outside SCOTUS. Don't want to give it away, but here's her butt." And it's a photo of a woman wearing, again, outerwear, and it's an anonymous butt that he has posted. So again, this is the guy claiming that he was just given that photo. He didn't take the photo of AOC, but he does post a lot of photos of women's butts and feet on Twitter non-consensually. And to give you an idea of his overall philosophy towards this sort of photography, I saw this interaction on Twitter. He tweeted in 2014, "Upskirt photo shots are now legal so long as they're taken in broad daylight." The Junior Sensation replies, "Haha, broad." And Eddie Scary says, "Lol, good catch, didn't even think of that." But you can understand why he'd be distracted, since he was thinking about all the new opportunities he'll have to take photos up women's skirts. This is a guy who writes for a conservative political newspaper online. They want to be taken seriously. He posts about bunions and upskirts and women's anonymous butts, as if women being outside are, whether they want to or not, taking part in some sort of reality TV show that plays out in real time on his Twitter account. That's not actually how any of this is supposed to work. Now, he had a chance, apparently, where he was standing a few feet behind Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the most exciting new politicians of the country. And rather than ask her about what she's going to be doing in office, her new push for a Green New Deal, the new caucus she's putting together, all of that, he instead decides to take a picture of her clothing to minimize her political philosophy as being invalid because she wears a coat. That is what he chose to do. That is what right-wing commentators and news analysts do. They waste these opportunities, they distract you with nonsense, whether it's a caravan or a coat, while all the rest of the country just falls apart in the background. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does have a lot of good things to talk about. We've been covering some this week. We will return to that soon. But I wanted to point this out to you to understand that going forward, you're going to see a lot more of this. They have been driven insane by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is under their skin. Someone pointed out that while she's going to have trouble making rent in DC, she's currently living rent-free in every right-winger's brain across the country, which is 100% true. You're going to see more of this, and we're going to have to stand in defense of her. Anyway, that's it for the first block. When we come back, there is an unfortunate breaking news death I want to address, and then casual jokes of voter suppression in an upcoming runoff election after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. A little bit more news to get to. I do want to remind you that later on, we are going to be joined by an activist pushing for ranked choice measures to start to spread more around the country, who was involved in that very successful Maine push over the past few years. So stay tuned for that. Before we get back to the news, though, we do have some breaking news. William Goldman has apparently passed away this morning at the age of 87. If you are not familiar with William Goldman, it is likely that you have actually consumed quite a bit of his creative output, perhaps without knowing it. He is a legendary Hollywood screenwriter, playwright, and author. You're seeing there shots from my favorite thing that William Goldman has ever produced, and that is The Princess Bride. He wrote the initial book under a pseudonym that became the screenplay The Princess Bride, after people fought for years and years to have it made into a movie. But a bunch of other things that he made, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Marathon Man, All the President's Men, both writing novels, writing interesting sort of behind-the-scenes analyses of Hollywood culture and what it's like to be a screenwriter. And so this is one of the people that in this area, screenwriting is perhaps as respected as anyone else in the country. And as is always the case, after it turned out that he died this morning, we saw so many of the people who'd worked with him or helped to bring his work to the screen talking about him. And yeah, he just did some great work. He was a mentor to a number of different people. I read Carrie Elwes' sort of biography of the making of The Princess Bride. He was the star of it. And there he talks about speaking with William Goldman and how involved he was in the production. Just an amazing creative mind. And just if I could just briefly mention on The Princess Bride, that is one of my top movies of all time. I saw it when I was very young, and it lodged itself in my brain, and I don't think it'll ever go away. Like, as a young person to see this sort of movie, of which at the time there were things like Willow or earlier versions of The Lord of the Rings, but this was fun and lively and witty and quick and bright in a way that a lot of fantasy hadn't been, that it was very much like they designed it in the movie. It's a fairy tale sort of come to life. And in the years since, in terms of what I have written, what I have read, the other movies that I've gone for, it has certainly made its mark. And all of that can be traced back to William Goldman initially. So a very sad day to see him pass. Obviously, he leaves a big hole in his wake, I guess. Okay, with that said, let's turn to other important news. At the end of this month, we have a big runoff election in Mississippi, where Cindy Hyde-Smith, who you've heard quite a bit about on this show over the past week, is going up against Democrat Mike Espy. I believe it's on the 27th of this month, because in the actual election, neither of them got to the 50% plus that they need to stop a runoff from happening. Now, since we knew that we were going to have that runoff, she has made news a couple of different times. I want to show you a video clip here of her talking with some college students about voter suppression. I apologize that the audio is not great, but take a listen to this. If you're listening to the podcast, that's going to be difficult to hear without the subtitles. But she says that I was reminded that there's a lot of liberal folks in those areas talking about some universities, and maybe we should make it a little bit harder for them to vote. And I think that's a good idea. That's what she said. That's not what she is going to cop to. And now that that video has gotten out, and I want to give credit to Lamar White Jr. On Twitter for having spread that, they have now responded to this controversy over a Republican senator nominee who is talking positively about voter suppression, saying, especially in the case of liberal college students, who we know have been the target of suppression measures across the country for years and years and years, that, maybe I think it's a good idea that we try to make it harder for them to vote. She is not just joking about some hypothetical. She is joking about the reality that college students have to live all across the country. So in response to this, in an email to the Washington Post, her spokeswoman, Melissa Scanlon, said that her comments about voting came on November 3rd while the senator was talking to four freshmen at Mississippi State University about an idea to have polling places on college campuses. That's what she said was a great idea. Someone pointed out that college campuses were liberal, and that's when she made the joke about not wanting everyone to vote. That was a joke. The polling places on college campuses is what she said was a great idea. Okay, so that is their response. You heard or tried to hear what she said. Does that in any way fit in with what she said? So supposedly the part that you don't see in that video is a conservative, presumably college student, says to her, hey, we want to have voting places on campus. And then if you believe that response, she responded by saying, yeah, we should make it harder for them to vote. That's a good idea. And that's consistent with being in favor of an idea to have more polling places. That does not make any sense whatsoever. Look, she could have gone the easy route, and she could have said, I was jokingly saying that I don't want people who aren't going to vote for me to vote. The Republicans have said that before. It would be awful, but it would at least be honest. Instead, she is lying, and this is part of a consistent pattern. If you recall, she is the person that just like a week ago it came out had been joking about that she would accept a front row seat at a public hanging. As she is running against a black Democrat, she is making jokes about going to attend a lynching. And that was a joke too, by the way, and now she won't even respond to it. So this is a woman who regularly says insane things, takes no responsibility for what she says, and wants to skate by and probably will skate by in this election. Now, it's coming up. If you live in that area, you should definitely vote for Mike Espy, and you should get involved in advance of it to make sure that people are registered and ready to go and that they do vote. But she's a Republican in Mississippi, so she has a gigantic advantage. So much so that constant controversies of the racism or voter suppression type are probably not enough to actually stop her, and she seems well aware of that. even as her campaign says ridiculous things like, the senator absolutely is not a racist and does not support voter suppression. Despite the fact that when she chooses to joke, those are the topics that she goes to. You could attempt any sort of joke, even if you're not funny. You could try to make any joke you want. I try constantly and generally fail, but I do try. And when I try, I don't make jokes about racial slurs and like the hall, like you don't have to do that. You understand that. So anyway, let's set aside what she said and let's turn to Mike Espy's campaign because they have put out a statement again, as they did in response to the public hanging thing. And this is his communications director, Danny Blanton, who said, for a state like Mississippi, where voting rights were obtained through sweat and blood, everyone should appreciate that this is not a laughing matter. Mississippians deserve a senator who represents our best qualities, not a walking stereotype who embarrasses our state. And that is a great response. And so, again, as with the previous comment, Mike Espy's campaign is being very, I guess, even-headed, very calm. They're not calling for anything to happen or anything like that. And that is certainly a strategy they're free to pursue. But if you're living in that area, if you're a Democrat, especially if you're an African-American Democrat, this has got to worry you. I mean, this is a woman who is likely to have an extreme amount of power over your life in the near future. And she believes some insane things. And she understands that she is surrounded by people who largely agree with her, that it is okay in 2018 to make jokes like this about lynchings, about voter suppression, even in the midst of an election where we have credible claims of voter suppression all over the place, including very close to Mississippi. Georgia and Tennessee, actually, are both the sites of absolutely massive campaigns of voter suppression over the past few years, targeting the exact sorts of communities that she thinks it's so funny to joke about. And so while many people in America are worried about whether our vote actually means anything anymore, whether we will even be able to engage with our democratic process, she thinks it's fun and games. And bear in mind, she was a Democrat up until 2010. So for those of you conservatives out there, like I saw a tweet from Charlie Kirk, who liked to joke about how back in the 60s there were Democrats in the KKK who don't understand what a party realignment is, who don't understand American political history over the past half century. Parties do change, politicians do change, especially in response to things like the party's stance on racial issues. And you saw that play out in the South decade after decade as more and more of those politicians switched over to the Republican Party as they continued to win in places that had traditionally been Democratic districts. That was a part of the realignment due to the changing stances on race of the different parties. Now, Cindy Hyde-Smith certainly is a delayed effect of that. But she has switched over, and with her willingness to bring up race seemingly out of nowhere, is it ridiculous to believe that that might have been one of the influences? I don't think necessarily so. And in a larger sense, whether she wins or not, understand that this is a battle that we need to engage in on voting rights, specifically in some of these states like Mississippi. Back in 2013, the Supreme Court invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, effectively allowing officials in southern states such as Mississippi to change election laws without federal approval. Previously, for the past 40 to 50 years, if in those traditional, let's keep it real, slave states, they had tried to make changes to how people vote, they had extra scrutiny from the Supreme Court. Now, John Roberts said a couple of years ago, you know, they don't need that anymore. They have proven that they can be trusted. Well, you've been watching how these elections have played out over the past few years. Do you think they can actually be trusted? Okay, we're going to take a break. We come back. More news. Scott Walker has been thrown out of Wisconsin government, but does he actually think it's a rebuke? We'll show you his response after this. Okay, so much to get to in this block. Let's see if we can do it. Scott Walker is apparently more of an optimist than I've given him credit for in the past. He was recently voted out of a Wisconsin's governor's position, losing to Tony Evers. It was a close race. I believe Tony Evers won by like 1.5%, something like that. But Walker, who had previously been considered one of sort of the up-and-coming national Republicans, he was seriously considered as a possibility in the 2016 Republican primary, did lose. He was voted out. But is that actually a rejection? No, he doesn't believe it is. He says, in no way did I see it as a rejection, but rather just a larger electorate than we've seen in the past, which is amazing. Like, so few words to contain so much meaning. So first of all, in no way is it a rejection. You lost. They voted for the other guy. So absent everything else, it's obviously a rejection. But is he trolling us? I don't know. The situation he sketches out as the cause for it makes it even more of a rejection. So he's saying, apparently, back in past elections, when lots of people didn't vote, then I could slide by. But now all these people are getting involved and all of them are voting and they really were enthusiastic about throwing me out. So clearly it's not a rejection. What are you talking about, buddy? Look, in the end, the important point is that Scott Walker, who is one of the worst, most anti-labor governors in America, is on his way out. Tony Evers is going to be way better on these issues. That's what's important. But this is the talk of a guy that is going to run again in the future. I'm not saying that because I'm worried. He's ridiculous. And if he ever tries to primary Trump or anything like that, it's like going to be like feeding him into a wood chipper. But this is an oddly optimistic guy. And I want to give him credit for even more optimism, saying, "We've been such reformers, I may have reformed myself out of a job." That's not how it works. He's saying that he's done such a good job as a governor that there's no reason for him to be governor anymore. That's how electorates work. They're like, man, this guy really nailed it. Let's vote for his opponent. No, that's not actually how it works. So look, that's the surface stuff. The important stuff underneath the surface is what he's going to do in his remaining time as governor. So there's a couple of different things. One is something that we talked about earlier this week that also happened earlier this year in North Carolina. Walker acknowledged that he's considering changes to give lawmakers more appointees to boards for the State Building Commission and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which would dilute the influence of the governor's appointees to those boards. So this is what we saw them try to do in North Carolina. When you have a Republican legislature and a Republican governor who then loses to a Democratic challenger, before the Democrat actually gets into office, the Republicans' allies in the legislature strip the governorship of its power. This is the definition of an anti-democratic move. They tried to do it in North Carolina and have largely failed, thankfully. Now they're going to try to do it in Wisconsin. The voters have said, we want a Democrat. And in response, the Republicans in office are saying, you can get one, but you're not going to get anything from it. They're not going to have any power. Okay, we're going to maintain that power. This is the respect for democracy that the Republican Party has right now. But it even goes beyond that, because there's one other thing he wants to do. He's now talking about changing Wisconsin's presidential primary date in 2020. So look, that's 2 years in advance, and it might seem, well, what's the difference? What does it matter what date they actually have? But he's doing this for an incredibly specific reason. Right now, he has this guy, Daniel Kelly, who's on the state Supreme Court. His term is set to end in 2020, and if he does a reelection bid, that date would be on the presidential primary date in 2020. Now, he is looking to the future and saying, Donald Trump is going to be on the ballot. There's going to be a very busy Democratic primary. Lots of Democrats are going to come out to vote. So I don't want my guy up for reelection on a day when it's likely that he may lose to a Democrat swept into power by another blue wave. So instead, I'm going to change the entirety of how we do primaries in the state to protect one guy, Daniel Kelly, and maintain his position on the state Supreme Court rather than risking a Democrat actually getting in there. So in both of these cases, when it comes to the power of the governor to put people into these boards, and when it comes to the power of the voters to shape the Supreme Court, Republicans have seen the way that the winds are blowing, and they're saying no. Democracy seems fine in theory, but if it's not going to go for us, screw it. We will manipulate things in every way that we can. So be on the lookout for that as it continues to develop. Perhaps if there's enough public pressure, we could actually stop this from happening in both of those cases. Little update for you. Jim Acosta was the source of a lawsuit that CNN is filing against the White House, I should say. And in response, many other media outlets, including Fox News, actually signed on in support of it. Now, that is not over. That is still going on, but we do have a development. Federal Judge Timothy J. Kelly sided with CNN on Friday morning, ordering that the White House has to reinstate Jim Acosta's press pass immediately, although potentially just temporarily. So this seems like it would resolve the situation, but it actually hasn't, at least from the point of view of the White House. So Kelly apparently did not rule on the underlying case that CNN put forward. That was that the White House had violated their First and Fifth Amendment rights when they snatched that pass away from Jim Acosta for, you know, committing the crime of having frustrated the president briefly. So he did grant CNN's request for that temporary restraining order, and he said he believes that CNN and Acosta are likely to prevail in the future. Now, bear that in mind as we move to other elements of this case. So one reason that his pass was initially taken away, as you saw, was the belief, thanks to a manipulated conspiracy theory website's video, that Jim Acosta had physically accosted an intern. It didn't actually happen. It was manipulated. There's now this doubt out there in the media about whether it was manipulated, but at least in the case of this judge, he knows what the deal is. Kelly said that Sanders, this is Sarah Huckabee Sanders, initial claim that Acosta had inappropriately touched the White House intern who was attempting to take the microphone away from him was likely untrue and partly based on evidence of questionable accuracy. So he is not accepting that video that she tweeted out at face value. So look, he says he's gonna get his pass and I think you're gonna end up winning, but the White House is still very confident. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders put out this statement: today, the court made clear that there is no absolute first First Amendment right to access the White House. In response to the court, we will temporarily reinstate the reporter's hard pass. We will also further develop rules and processes to ensure fair and orderly press conferences in the future. There must be decorum at the White House. So that first thing, that there's no absolute First Amendment right to access the White House, no, they didn't say that. I mean, likely there is no absolute First Amendment right, but that is not what the judge actually said. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in her defense, probably said that after not actually reading what the judge put out. But that is not actually true, although expect to see it on Fox News many times in the near future. CNN is very happy about this result. Jim Acosta likely is as well. And as the judge said, it is likely that in the future they will win this as it goes forward. But bear in mind the stance of the White House. There must be decorum at the White House. And you saw that all throughout this week. There has to be respect to the president. There has to be respect to the press secretary. And if there isn't that, screw the First Amendment. We can throw you out if we want. That's their belief. We'll see if the courts actually uphold that. Okay, with that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Kara McCormick, advocate for ranked choice voting, is going to be joining the show to talk about some of the recent developments in Maine and possibly across the country after this. Yesterday, we learned that another Democrat had flipped a seat, this time in Maine. That is Jared Golden, but his is a little bit different. His win came about as a result of the state's new ranked choice voting system. Very exciting stuff, and so I am excited to now welcome to the show Kara Brown McCormick. This is a co-founder of the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting. Kara, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
We're very glad to have you here, especially on this particular topic. So ranked choice voting is something that we've talked about multiple times on the show, but for those who might not be familiar with it, can you give a brief explainer for our audience?
Sure. So ranked choice voting is gives you the power to rank candidates from your most favorite to your least favorite. It was the nation's first use of ranked choice voting last night in a general election for Congress. It's just an instant runoff system. So Rachel Maddow last night talked about it last night. She said, why are you calling it ranked choice voting? You should just call it the 1-2-3 system. So ballots are counted in rounds. The last place candidates lose, and then the candidate with the majority of the vote wins.
Yeah, so it seems, I think once you explain it, it makes a lot of sense to people. There are some concerns about whether people will get it. I think that that's generally a bit condescending towards Americans. I think that we can figure it out, but we're going to talk about the pros and the cons. I just want to briefly make note of the history in Maine of the push for this system. It has apparently been somewhat complicated, right?
So it's been a 4-year battle. We started in, about August of 2014. And in November of 2014, we collected 30,000 signatures at the polls and then another 40,000 signatures over the course of 2015. And we landed ourselves on the ballot in 2016. We won that election with the second largest vote of the people of Maine in the history of citizen referendums.
Wow.
And then our law became the law on January 7th of 2017. And about 4 days later, I realized that the legislature was not excited about the new law and would probably repeal it. And on October 23rd of 2017, that's exactly what they did. So under Maine's constitution, we have the power to do something called a people's veto. So in 88 days, in the middle of winter, last winter at this time, we collected 80,000 signatures, handed them into the Secretary of State, froze the law in place, and we used it for the first time on June 12th of 2018. And then on June 12th of 2018, we had a citizens referendum, and again, we won, this time with 8% margin. And so we used ranked choice voting for the first time in a general election a few days ago on Tuesday.
Yeah, and it's already determined an election, as we said, Jared Golden's seat. So you are an advocate for this. You are pushing for this to become more common. It seems like the people of Maine very excited about it. They were willing to support it multiple times. What are the advantages of setting up this sort of system? Why should we want this?
Well, a lot of times people go into the ballot box and they feel like they're voting for the lesser of two evils. So this really opens up the system. If there's a candidate that you really, really prefer, you're allowed to put him or her first. So you can kind of vote for your hope rather than for your fear. You can vote for the person that you like the most without being afraid that you're going to elect the candidate that you like the least, which is what happens over and over and over again in Maine. So we have a very strong, proud tradition of independent voting in Maine. We have an independent Senator, Angus King, and 9 out of the last 11 governor's races in Maine have been decided. The person who's been elected has been elected with less than 50% of the vote.
Yeah.
So a lot of times in our elections, we're talking about this one's going to, if you vote for that one, it's a wasted vote. If you vote for this one, then, you know, you're, people get called spoilers. And we're not talking about what we should be talking about, which is other things besides who's ahead and who's behind. We should be talking about who has the best ideas.
Exactly. And this frees people up to do that. And in your example, I was looking at so Paul LePage, who's an incredibly controversial now former governor, he initially won with 37.5% of the vote. I mean, that's hardly a vote of confidence by the state, but because of the system we have, the first past the post, he was able to do that. So ranked choice voting could have stopped that potentially from happening.
You get it. That's exactly right. And then he was able to govern only representing this very small smidgen of Maine people. And so we hope that ranked choice voting will also change the way that people govern, because they'll be elected with a broader majority of the people and then therefore sort of responsible to a broader majority of the people.
And you know, it is odd that this is still somewhat controversial and that people oppose this. It seems like it's in basically everyone's interest. If you're a third party candidate or a third party itself, if you set up this sort of system, you will no longer be tarred as a spoiler and have people sort of try to push you out of the scene. If you're one of the major parties, you no longer have to worry about the spoiler effect. You just have to run good candidates. So why is it so controversial? Yes. Why are people fighting against this?
I think that anytime you try to change something, the powers that be are going to try to stop you. And part of our battle has been also in the courts. Last week, we were taken to court once again. So I think that was the inside of the fifth courtroom that I've seen in this battle. I think that people are, however, in Maine and hopefully across the country, feeling like they have the responsibility to make our state and our country a better place for our children, for our grandchildren. The way to do this is to change the way that we elect our leaders. We need to ensure that candidates who are opposed by a majority of voters cannot win. And we need a system that works again. And this is the most stunningly right idea at this moment in history that exists. And, you know, I've worked in politics for 25 years, and this is the answer to what ails us, which is the partisan politics that are just tearing our country apart. Yeah. And we agree about so much more than we disagree about in this country, but we've got a system that's trying to sort us into one or the other. And so anyway, Maine, we made a big first step yesterday, and it's pretty exciting for all of us who work so hard for it.
It certainly is. So if people watching this show are interested in pursuing ranked choice voting, possibly in their own states, what advice would you give them? Are there any organizations they should support, resources they should go to?
Well, I think the main thing that I want to tell everyone is that we started this little movement in Maine with 4 people. So, and we had no money. And all we had was a really great idea, and the people came to us. So don't feel like you need to have some grand organization in order to start your own ranked choice voting movement in your own state. If you feel like it's what would help your state work better, and if you think it's something that the people in your state would appreciate. And, you know, please come to the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting on Facebook. And you can definitely also come to rcvmaine.com, or another organization is called morevoice.org. And that's how you can find us. And we're happy to help you. We just want to spread the word and, you know, get this message out there. And hopefully people will pick it up and run with it.
Well, thank you very much, Kara Brown McCormick. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Have a good day. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to take a look back at the week. What have we learned after this? What, if anything, did we learn? We're going to take a look back in a segment we call This Week I Learned. Yeah. Okay, we didn't learn that much, but we're gonna see. I tweeted to you guys to let me know what you've learned, and here's a few things. Matt S. learned that rain makes Trump hide indoors, which leaves him bored on top of scared as a result of a bunch of these things. So he rage tweets and harasses other world leaders at our expense. Not surprising, just more manic nuance made clear. Exactly, and yeah, he's been angry this week, but the thing about him not wanting to go to the vet memorial because his hair was gonna get wet really enraged him. And then a couple days later, more confirmation came out that that was in fact exactly why he didn't go, which is embarrassing. If that came out about me, I would be mad about it too, but I would have just gone to the ceremony. And it makes me wonder, so he doesn't want his hair to get wet. Does he not want to get his hair wet because of the reason all of us wouldn't want to get our hair wet? Or does something happen when his hair gets wet? That's what I have to wonder about. Great Scott learned, he didn't learn this, but he did want to contribute to a conversation around the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez thing with a great quote by Russell Brand that is, "When I was poor and complained about inequality, they said I was bitter. Now that I'm rich and I complain about inequality, they say I'm a hypocrite. I'm beginning to think they just don't want to talk about inequality," which is totally true. And she got across that message as well. She's in a position where it doesn't matter what she wears. They will find a reason to say that her arguments about the economy and about the state of the working class are invalid, regardless of whether she was dressed like some pauper from, you know, a Dickens novel or whether she came out there in a Melania Trump-level outfit. They would find a reason to disregard her either way. Moving on, stupid sexy Flanders learned that we're all rich because we all have refrigerators. And so if you don't watch Fox News, first of all, congratulations. Second of all, that's what he's alluding to. So it was more common back in the Bill O'Reilly days, but his argument against concern over poverty was always, here's the percentage of Americans that have refrigerators, here's the percentage of Americans that have TVs, and if you can heat or cool your food, you don't get to complain about anything. And so if 96% of Americans have refrigerators, I guess we don't have poverty in this country. It's a ridiculous argument, but it exists to this day. You can see screenshots of all of those graphics they put up on Fox News. They really think that this is convincing. And, you know, maybe for some of their viewers, it actually is. Aaron learned that Florida is a preview of 2020, and it scares me. So that is 100% true. So they are still doing their recount in Florida as we speak. There were massive problems with people being deceived by the layout of the ballots. As of yesterday, in one of the counties, I forget if it was Palm Beach or Broward, the person that did the recount uploaded the information 2 minutes late. And so at least as of yesterday, they weren't going to use any of that recount information that was accrued over the course of 5 days. This is a ridiculous way to run elections, whether it's senator, governor, or potentially in 2020, the presidential election. Now, if it makes you feel better, in a weird way, Florida seems so right-wing at this point that I don't know if we needed to even worry about possibly competing there. But if we do, I am very worried about what election night might be like. If Florida's the deciding vote, we might have a return to 2000-era electoral politics. Next, Justin Cobb says, "I learned that if I spent more money on hats, I could have voted more than once." Talking about the conspiracy theory that Donald Trump tweeted out, that people are voting, going back to their car, putting on different clothes, and then running back in to vote. He said that without any evidence, and a lot of evidence to the contrary. Americans hate voting. It is a multi-year effort to try to get them to vote even once. I don't think they're bringing changes of clothes to the polls. But that is what he says, and many of his followers will, of course, accept it. NoFate97 learned that Nancy Pelosi is perfect, and 2010, 2016 never happened. Yes, so if you are advocating for a particular individual to challenge Nancy Pelosi, or even saying that there should be a challenge, you're sexist or whatever. That is the counter argument from those who support Nancy Pelosi. I would say that if you believe Nancy Pelosi is awesome, make that case. Don't say that there shouldn't be a conversation. That said, that's our week. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next Monday. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.